We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. It's our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. And we're also happy to have back on the program once again Dennis Barron. He's professor of English at the University of Illinois. Occasionally, he's here on the program. We talk about language, talk a little bit about language news. We have talked about how language changes, even though people don't always like it. It does, in spite sometimes of people's efforts to effect deliberate change. We can talk about all of those. If people have questions about grammar, you're welcome to call and get an answer. If there's something that some question that is puzzling you, the man that we sometimes call Dr. Grammar will do his best to help you out, any and all of that. And, of course, if people want to complain, it won't do you any good, but you're welcome to call in and complain about misuse as well. Dennis has authored a number of books about language. His most recent is A Better Pencil, Readers, Writers, and the Digital Revolution. It was published in 2009. And that's a book that looks at how the digital revolution has influenced the way that we read and write. You might want to take a look at that. He also has a blog, The Web of Language, where he posts essays about various language issues. And if you take a look at that, you can look, for example, at his top 10 language stories for the year 2010. He has his entry into now the increasingly popular sport of selecting the word of the year. So you can read about things like that on his blog. Questions here are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. And you may also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Hey, thank you very much for being here.
I'm on. Okay.
Yes.
My light wasn't on.
My light frequently is not on, but I'm here anyway.
All right. My external lights are on.
Oh, good. Good.
If anybody's home, that remains to be seen.
All right. It seems that this word of the year thing, either that or writing articles about the words that we use and what that may say about where we are at that particular time, this has become extremely popular. I think countries, they're now doing Word of the Year.
Other countries are doing Word of the Year. Other countries are, amazingly enough, interested in language. And not just our language, but even their language.
Even their languages. I thought it was only the French.
Oh, yeah.
They were obsessively interested in their own language. Why?
Why?
Let's talk a little bit about Word of the Year. There are at least three. The new Oxford American Dictionary came up with one. Their word of the year
was refudiate.
Oh, you got to love her.
No, actually, you don't.
You don't. Oh, okay.
You don't.
You might. You might.
Not on left-leaning pinko public radio.
Here's the thing. Poor Sarah, you know, after she got a lot of heat for this word refudiate.
She seems to be the new George Bush in terms of language.
I guess. Well,
she doesn't mispronounce things. She just
makes
says
stuff.
Things that get people upset.
Stuff up. So here she was taken to task for putting together two perfectly fine
repute
words
and
refute and repudiate.
Repudiate.
Two right. words that are just that and I think some people said we didn't need to.
Something
mash them up and make a new word.
Well, something that Lewis Carroll did all the time.
Well, and she
called them portmanteau words.
Portmanteau words.
Portmanteau is an old word that meant suitcase. It's like two words folded up into one suitcase.
That's
we call
nice.
Them blends.
I like that.
We call them blends.
Portmanteau words.
Yeah.
Well, and in her defense, she said, she invoked
Shakespeare
the
coined
bard.
Words.
Right.
Shakespeare coined words. Gotta love it.
So is are we? Are we just because maybe we'd
she
like
takes,
to smack
this
her?
Way.
Is that fair when she says, well, look, of course people make up words all the time. What are you giving me a hard time for?
Yeah, she's the bard coined words, or at least was the first user of many of the words. We assume he made some of them up. But, you know, her approach to the vocabulary is don't retreat, reload.
So we'll leave that image aside. So is that just, you know,
people
well,
do
of
it
course,
all the
people
time.
Do that all
people
the time.
Do
so
it all
why
the time.
Should we give her
we
why
mash
we
up songs, why don't we mash up words?
Mm-hmm.
Smog is a blend of smoke and fog. Brunch, breakfast, lunch. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a common linguistic process. The problem with refudiate as word of the year is it just does nothing for me.
So what
it's fine to mash up the word, but to elevate it to thank the Academy for giving me this word, this statue of a word, it doesn't do it for me, nor does the American Dialect Society's Choice app, as in a phone app or a computer app, the next big app. Yeah, it's a word. It's been floating around for a while. Yeah, but does it? To me, the word has to epitomize something about the year gone by to merit the award.
So do you like Merriam-Webster? Their word,
yeah, austerity.
Austerity.
Austerity. That makes a little more sense because at least it links us to the effects of the recession, the economy, even though the market is recovering a little. Jobs are still down, and people are walking around not with that customary smile on their face and that sense of American exceptionalism, but, you know, boy, the economy is bad. Yeah. I can't afford it. I can barely afford to come over here this morning, David.
And with the big performance fee that you get,
I know. It all goes to my agent, and then Uncle Sam.
It's tough. It's very tough.
Mm-hmm. And we need more tax breaks for the rich.
Are you running for something?
No, I'm probably running from something. I will be after the show.
Yeah, exactly. We'll provide your email and your phone number.
And all this is leading up to my choice of word of the year, which we can't even say on the radio.
I know. I was very distressed. Your word
is
an acronym.
It's an acronym.
For a commonly used, very commonly used phrase, I'm sure, which contains a word that we cannot say on the air.
Right. WTF. We can say those words. We can say letters.
Okay. And I think probably most people, for people who know what it means, they know what it means, and other people, you
several
probably don't
people
want to know.
Actually asked me after I designated my choice of words,
they said, what does it mean?
Now, admittedly, they were, slightly older than the mean, but still, come on. They got to get out more.
Is this something that is one of those things that's commonly used in texts and tweets and
it is.
That sort of thing?
But you start hearing it in conversation too. That's one of the things.
So people are saying they're saying rather than saying the phrase, they're saying
the phrase rather than the three words
yes
spoken out. They use the letters instead. I've heard people walking down the hall in an animated conversation and one of them says to the other, OMG, OMG.
Yes, which means oh my god,
oh my god.
I'm really – and how old were these people?
These were college age. Adults.
These were not according to the law. These were not your faculty peers that were saying OMG.
Well, no.
Do they say WTF?
Some of them ask me what it means.
So the point here, it sounds like your selection, the point was it expresses the fact that in this last year in 2010, there were many points along the year when you just sort of had to throw up your hands and say, what? What is going on? Right. Do you have an answer to the question?
What was the question?
What is going on?
Oh, no. I'm not even listening, apparently.
Yes. That was the question. That is the question, isn't it? What is going on?
Question. You're asking the wrong person. I was absent. That's my.
All right.
I walked through life with that constant sense I must have been absent I didn't know what's going on.
That's why it's your word of the year. No, you don't have an answer.
It doesn't epitomize the word, it epitomizes me.
It's the spirit, it's the zeitgeist.
The zeitgeist.
You can look that one up, too.
Yeah.
All right.
And your Funkin' Wagnalls.
The one thing I promise I will get to this call. The one thing that I did sort of semi seriously want to ask you about it, the Merriam-Webster, their choice austerity was based on the number of people who were going to their online dictionary to look it up.
Yeah, and that's nice because they can actually track when a word goes is mentioned by a public official, let's say, or a celeb, or appears in a news story. Mm. They can actually track online lookups, and they have a chart that they report out. You can find it on their website, you know, most looked up word this week or something like that. And, you know, there are spikes, actually document spikes after, you know, Obama said we took a shellacking or something like that. People run to the dictionary to look up shellacking to see, they probably have a sense of what it means, but to confirm or to see more, find out more about the word and stuff.
There was a big spike, apparently, he used the word sanctimonious.
Sanctimonious, yeah.
And so everybody ran to the online dictionaries because they went, well, what does that mean?
Yeah. Who uses that besides professors?
So I'm just sort of surprised that there are, like, austerity, that there are apparently people who would say they don't know what austerity means.
I know. I don't think this is a sign of people not knowing what the word means in many cases. In some cases, yeah. But it's a sign that they don't have a very precise definition, and they're looking for some precision to... Yeah. Does this count as austerity? Is what I'm going through austerity, or does it mean something else? That's I think maybe.
All right. Dennis Barron is here. He's professor of English at the University of Illinois, and is here to talk about words and language.
And if I don't know the answer to your question, I will make it up.
He will make one up. Absolutely.
I will make it up. I'm very creative.
333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. You may also send us an email to will-talk@illinois.edu. Someone who's been very patient with us in our foolishness here at Kankakee, line 4. Hello.
Yes, thank you for taking my call,
sure.
David. When you get finished with your interview, you're going to say thank you to your interviewee.
And I will say thank you back. And you want to know why is it...
I want to know, why don't you say...
You're welcome. Because you're not welcome. No, I don't know. But I've noticed that too, and we've had calls before about this question. Why have people switched from thank you, you're welcome, to thank you, no, thank you? And I don't know why, but it certainly is the fact that people are doing this. And does it indicate a lack of welcome? Or I think not. I think it's just a shift in the politeness convention. One of the things that happens with terms that we use frequently is that they tend to lose meaning. And so people maybe shift over to something else, not just to give it a little variety, but also to try to restore the sense that there's some meaning in the exchange. I mean, it doesn't. Thank you, thank you. It's a formula more than anything else. Not necessarily a heartfelt emotion, but it's just a formula, and people change formulas, you know, the way they change their socks.
I should just accept it and not worry about it.
Yeah, we change hello, goodbye terms much more frequently than that, and sometimes people comment on it, but
get over it.
Yeah. I mean, how many times do you get an email now that just starts out, "Hey"?
Yeah, you're right.
New greeting term, new opening of the conversation channel.
Hey is something
signal.
That animals eat normally.
Ah, yes, hay is for horses. I remember that from my youth. But
right,
if you say that today, people just look at you funny because they make no... I mean, we're a very urban society. Hay is for horses.
Well, thank you.
All right, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for the call.
And you're welcome.
We appreciate that. Well, someone also, I think, when we've done this program in the past, has talked about... Now, it's not the thank you, you're welcome thing. It's that you thank people and instead of saying either... thank you back.
No problem.
They say no problem.
No problem.
And people ask the same question. Say, well, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Well,
it doesn't mean anything. It's a meaningless response phrase, and it essentially means, you know, it's a politeness way of saying you really didn't put me out, even if you did. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not necessarily demeaning of the action, but an expression of humility on the part of the speaker. You may have exerted yourself quite a bit, but you say, "Oh, no problem. I would do this for you anytime." You know?
I think that's a more charitable kind of spin on it than I would give.
Okay,
but my feeling always was that in rather than when you say you're welcome, you're saying to the person something like, I'm happy to be doing this for you.
Mm-hmm.
And that when you say no problem, what you're saying is, well, it doesn't inconvenience me.
I didn't even notice.
I didn't even break
it's
a sweat.
A minor, it didn't break
yes.
a sweat.
But, yes.
I don't think people really mean that
no.
either.
Okay.
I think it's just a formula. It's a meaningless formula.
Very well. Let's talk with someone else.
I mean, if they really said, boy, you know, I worked really hard to do this, aren't you even, couldn't you be a little more grateful? You know,
that's gratitude for you.
That's gratitude for you. You know, we wouldn't be happy with that kind of response.
All right.
I worked very hard. I want you to really appreciate how much I've done for you in my life. I mean, I've been coming here to WILL several times a year for over 20 years. I've watched you go gray. I haven't changed.
Have you looked at the picture on your website
lately?
Yeah,
it needs to be seriously updated.
Uh-huh. Yes, it is true. We've been ingrates all of this
and you've
year.
Been in, what did you give me a mug once?
Yeah, and you could use a new mug.
I could use a new mug.
All right,
we are the car guys of grammar.
Oh Lord, and people are turning us off in droves. Let's go to another caller. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
First, I want to make a different sort of comment. My wife and I listen to WILL because we love classical music, and we've sort of made our peace with the fact that public radio is very left-wing. But we still get a bit upset when we hear something like you two making fun of Sarah Palin. Okay, that's that.
That was me. It wasn't David. I want to make it very clear that he is a very neutral host. I'm a very ungrateful guest.
Well, I've been listening for a long time occasionally, and I might take issue with that. But anyway, what I was asking about, has anybody given, sort of serious, scholarly, systematic thought to what seems to me the sudden appearance of words with funny meanings? And the only two to come to mind right now are multiple and issue to mean problem, as in he has obesity issues.
Ah, yes, yes. He's
got,
or he's got issues,
just to
right. indicate a troubled
right.
person or a
right.
person whose behavior you don't like.
Yeah, I mean, that,
he's got issues.
As far as I know, is both of them are fairly recent.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden, you can't avoid them. You can't go through it.
Right. It probably comes out of the realm of psychobabble on radio talk shows. But
or just ordinary people.
Yeah.
Use both of them that way.
Right.
You know, she was hit multiple times. That's that sort of thing.
That one, I'm not sure what you're driving at with multiple.
Well, I'm just
but issues, yeah. Yeah.
If anybody like you, a linguist, a language scholar, has ever just sat down and thought about this, how does this happen? How does it spread? Why do people pick things like this up when they have perfectly good words already?
Sometimes I wish language would stop changing and people would stop doing this, because I need a break. You know, I need to take a vacation from language sometimes. But there are multiple reasons why language changes, and you know, the umbrella explanation is that language changes. It's part of the nature.
But
of language to be a variable system,
yeah,
so a system where everything is in not really in a total equilibrium, but things are pushing and pulling and moving around. And I mean, if you look at an individual's, forget about words, just think about sounds, the sounds that we make when we pronounce a sound as part of our, when we make an utterance, when we say something. With words in it, we don't necessarily pronounce those words exactly the same way every time.
Right.
There's variability in the production system. So it should be no surprise that there's variability in the lexical system as well. And things go in and out of favor because, we get bored. We push words around. Word play is part of how language works, there's a creative function. We make up new things. We say things all the time that we've never said before. We say things that we hear things that we've never heard before. We're able to understand them, and it's the brilliance of the system that allows this to happen. You know, how is it that you can understand something you've never heard before? Yeah. It's not that you've memorized every possible combination of words and sounds in the language. It's that you have the ability to take that input and your brain interprets it.
Well, is there a theoretical difference, you might say, between...
But you might prefer a more right-wing analysis of the subject. Which would say that there are rules and people break them and they need to be punished for it.
Oh, I love it. But is there a theoretical difference between a new word being coined to mean something that there wasn't a word for before, like
yes.
app? I still don't know what app means.
It's a shortening for application.
And using a word like multiple or a word like issue, where there are already perfectly good words to express those meanings, it seems to me.
Right, those are both parts. And so you would be comfortable with new words for new things. Okay, you invent a new product, you discover a new subatomic particle, you come up with a new philosophical system, and you need names for the terms or a new... You know, a new chemical process or something like that. You assign names for them. What should we call the baby? Kind of thing. But for perfectly good terms that are already there, why bother?
Right,
it's an expenditure of intellectual effort that we could, you know, we could take a nap instead. We could learn a new language or something. We could be using that brain power, putting it to a more useful effect. Yeah, it is not efficient. You are right. It is not efficient to do this. And yet we do it, and so we got to figure out why is it? Why take something that's good and change it?
Maybe they just want to be a little bit different, something like that.
Yeah.
But I just wondered if people like you had given it any thought.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay, thank you.
But it can't be stopped. If that's your underlying worry, how do we stop this from happening? Because I don't like the new things. I don't like app because it's, you know, there's already a perfectly good word for it. That it's not going to stop it.
Well, it seems like that app is, in fact, it's a good, short, very functional word for that.
Quite so.
You could take more time to say that, but app, I think, really
but
works,
you know,
very well.
As one of my correspondents pointed out, WTF takes longer to say than if you actually said the phrase, because there are more syllables in the letters than there are in, you know, vocalizing the words.
Well, it gets you around not saying...
It gets you around the taboo.
Yes. So you can say it. Without saying it.
You can say it without saying it, and that's what euphemisms are, if I can say the word.
Our guest is Dennis Barron. He's professor of English at University of
Illinois. Left-wing professor of English.
Apparently. Oh, I didn't notice. It is here
Soi-disant professor of English.
And he is here occasionally on this program, for which we have not adequately thanked him, to talk about language and questions.
And after this show, you may not want to.
Yeah, we're going to crush you. We're going to take your card
out
of the Rolodex.
Off the rotation.
Exactly. Let's talk next with someone in LaSalle County. Line 2. Hello.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I don't think anybody really cares who the professor votes for. We got the Electoral College. It doesn't seem to matter, and I'm sure Bill O'Reilly would love to have him on his show to discuss language. And if you're interested in listening to words being chopped up and mangled and invented, they do a great job on the old... All in the Family, Archie Bunker character. I mean, it's just funnier than when he's talking to his son-in-law, who's a professor, of course. He's an intellectual, and Archie's mangling the words. It's just, and then Michael Stivic just throws his hands up and walks away. He can't win an argument even when he's right. But I am trying to force myself not to use the word no problem.
Okay.
And I can't. It's like ingrained in my head.
There's an app for that.
Actually,
there is. Apple has filed and recently got approval for a patent that will censor material on your iPhone. They haven't put this into any kind of practice yet, but the idea is that it will scan outgoing texts and incoming texts or emails for a list of forbidden words. And the main goal seems to be to keep kids from talking dirty on the phone.
I'm having a problem in normal conversation.
Right. But I mean, it's not. I mean, other people are thinking of how can we scrub the language of these words we don't like.
I personally don't like saying no problem to people. I like to say you're welcome.
Right.
And I
but you find yourself doing it, right?
I can't stop.
You can't stop. It's like it's gone viral.
Yeah, and I got another problem with now that the Republicans are going to try to overturn quote-unquote Obamacare, which they can't do.
Yeah.
And the media and the journalists call it kabuki theater, kabuki. I don't like that. For some reason,
yeah.
I know it's a Japanese.
It's culturally insensitive to do.
But
to
they're it. Supposed to be, and it's they've like stereotyped it to mean like they're wasting their time. Is that what it means?
Yeah, I mean they're going through the motions rather than doing anything meaningful.
Uh-huh.
Speaking of Japanese drama, what about no drama Obama? But that's just a different no, right?
That's a very sophisticated joke.
Yes,
yeah, that was over my head. Can you explain that one?
No is another kind of Japanese drama. For
like, spelled N-O-H.
N-O-H.
Okay.
Like, as in kabuki. Well, no, you had to be there.
In my big...
And I wasn't.
And my big problem I have a word with in journalism and media is proactive.
Ah, yes.
Can't we just be active without being proactive?
No. Active is no longer good enough.
I expect...
You got to be... I mean, next it's got to be mega proactive or... Hyper proactive,
I expect.
And if you're not proactive, you're nano proactive.
Yeah, I expect people in media and in politics to be articulate, and especially journalists. And you guys are great on WILL. And I expect you to be smarter than me.
And okay.
You're going to be disappointed.
You're going to be disappointed.
They're going to have to let the people go that can't. You know what I mean. See, I can't come up with the words right now. But please, God, don't say proactive. And don't say kabuki.
We'll try. We'll note those down.
Don't say no problem to me ever, or they're going to have to lock me up in a nut house. Thank you.
Thank you. You are quite welcome.
You are quite welcome.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah,
gotcha.
I didn't even set you up on purpose. Thank you, bye.
We'll never miss the opportunity.
To be set up.
Yeah. That's great, right. Yeah. Janice Barron is here. He's professor of English at the University of Illinois. And occasionally he's on the program. We talk about language. And you might want to look at his blog. What's it called? Oh, yes, The Web of Language. And for his comments on matters like this, questions welcome 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. I was going to ask you here as another attempt to ask something serious.
You want to know if the government does control our grammar.
Well, I know you've written about
that. I just posted that last
night. You just posted that. And you're not the only one who is writing on this.
I know. This has gotten a lot of ink.
Yes.
If you can call digital writing, use that.
Do we still do that? Talk about is something getting a lot of ink, even if it's
something
that
exists. I think it's an
expression.
It doesn't have to be literal ink. It could be digital ink, e-ink.
Is there some sort of, I suppose some people would say that public education was in fact a government conspiracy.
Right, and as I commented in my post, yes, the public education is an arm of government, but its effect on our grammar is minimal. Ask any graduate of a public institution to speak or write, and you will see that there's been no major change. So it's you know, yeah, government may try to control our grammar all the time, but it's totally ineffective in doing so.
Yeah. Well, and we have talked about, I'm sure you have written about, other people have written about over the years, not necessarily government, but individuals who thought that there was some sort of problem with language.
Language reformers.
People tried to say...
They try to reform the language.
Pass rules.
Pass a rule. There ought to be a law against saying no problem or shortening words or mashing them up together.
And you might as well just give it up because it's not happening.
Give it up. No. The only way to stop it, I said this once on the program and too much dismay, put a plastic bag over the person's head. Maybe they'll stop. But Anything other than that is just not going to work. I mean, you got to get someone to stop using language altogether if you want to control their language. It just springs up.
Do you think this question goes back to the idea that now we have online dictionaries, and one of the things that you can do now is you can see patterns of, you can see what words people are looking up.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think that now
and is that,
that
an invasion of privacy? Oh, no.
Probably. Let's talk about iPads and e-books and invasion of privacy. Do you think that, though, that now that more and more people have easy access online to dictionaries, do people, do you think, look up words more often? Are people actually using them now?
I think so. People had these paper dictionaries around for centuries. And what do we use them for? I mean, I always ask this question. What do you use dictionaries for? You go to somebody's house and take the dictionary and shake it out. What do you find? You know, dried flowers, occasionally a hidden, you know, $20 bill for emergency. You never remember what you hid it under.
Emergency.
People use dictionaries to press flowers, hold doors open, prop up uneven table legs, stuff like that. More than they do, I think, to look up words. But with the electronic access, I mean, if you've got a touchscreen reader of some kind, you just press on the word and a definition will pop up automatically. You can't stop it. It's like programmed to do this. So, people are looking up words more. Are they understanding them any better? I doubt it. Because what you get is simply a synonym or a simplistic explanation that really doesn't, you know, really doesn't unpack the word for you necessarily. My students use thesauruses all the time on their computers to because they've been enjoined to vary their vocabulary when they write, but they come up with these silly-sounding words because, you know, the thesaurus suggests a synonym and they really don't have a handle on that particular word, and they just plug it in, and it doesn't quite work.
All right. We have a number of callers. We have some emails here. Let us go next to line 3, Piatt County. Hello.
Oh, hello.
Yes.
Very quickly, I hope, number one, I want to nominate input as an annoying word.
We will put that in.
Because I think that sounds like an electrical term, and yet we ask for our input. Then the second thing I want to ask is, why is it after watching British shows and then listening to the BBC?
We all talk funny.
Well, somebody said that we assume because they're from England they speak English, but yes. You probably speak a different sort of English. But why do they say in hospital?
Oh, yes.
And when did we start using the article more?
Yes, doctor will see you now. It's just a different use of the article. We put the in there and they don't. And why do they treat, you know, singular nouns like government or team as taking plural verbs, and we give them singular. Oh. The government say.
Okay, but then my third thing question was a little more serious about the young man that in Tucson. There was a sidebar in the Tribune when they first reported it the first couple of days that said that he had been affected by the writings of somebody whose name I can't remember.
David Wynn Miller.
About the power of grammar.
Yeah.
And the question that he asked, apparently, the congresswoman had to do with what about government if words have no meaning, which I thought was a really great question.
Mm-hmm.
But it just seems kind of sad that we assume that, you know, government tries to use words and propaganda, and it just seems sad, and I just thought it was interesting that he was upset about grammar. I said, so many students his age don't know the word hardly.
Yeah, I think this is the least of his problems. But,
yeah.
You know, but
yeah.
It is a sort of touched a nerve in a way, because there has been a lot of commentary about this guy David Wynn Miller that they're linking up to him. And I don't know if there was any connection or not. Is some nutcase who made up his own language, sort of based on English, but uses it to clog the courts with meaningless petitions and
yeah, and I think
it's just gobbledygook.
Yeah. Well, those are my comments, and I want to thank you for your erudition. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Our guest is
Dennis. See if there's an upsurge in lookups for erudition.
For erudition. Dennis Barron is here. You can look him up on the web at Web of Language.
Yeah. The antonym of erudition is my name, yes.
And his pictures is right there. Questions welcome. He's a professor of English, and we talk about language when he is on the program. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu, and we will talk next with someone in Robinson, line 4. Hello.
Yes, David. I'm an old man, but try to be understanding of young children who are using texting. But I must confess that I was at first did not understand LOL because in the 1950s, unthinking people called the new growth of ecology as run by little old ladies in tennis shoes. So when I first saw LOL in its current sense, I misunderstood it that way. But I have an offering for WTF. It could be an acronym for midweek. We used to call hump day Thursday. So midweek is Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, WTF.
Okay.
As for the man who had, and I pun here, issues with the word issues.
By the way, I think it's the FBI, or maybe it was the CIA, designated its investigative unit looking into the WikiLeaks as the WikiLeaks Task Force, which they abbreviate WTF.
Please continue.
Yeah, sorry.
The man with issues should look up in a big dictionary issues in law, which simply mean problems or disputes. Thank you.
All right, I thank you. LOL, by the way, for anyone who is not sure what that means, that stands for laughing out loud.
Yes.
Right. And it's another one of those acronyms that end up that came about and people ended up using them in text.
In text
also
and
in
chat.
Emails,
chat.
In chat. Okay.
Chat. And sometimes you'll hear people actually pronouncing it as a word, and they'll say lol.
Yeah.
Or LOL. And there's some discussion sometimes of whether you should say the letters separately or pronounce the thing as a word, because it is pronounceable as a word, lol. Is it becoming a word in and of itself?
Mm-hmm. Have there been acronyms that actually became words?
SNEFU? Scuba?
Ford?
No, not Ford. there's a joke about cars, you know, fuel, oil, and repair daily. But Ford is actually a name. But scuba, self-contained underwater breathing apparatus, radar, radio detection and ranging. What was the other
laser
one? SNAFU, situation normal, all what WTF up. An old army term, I believe.
Yeah.
So it is possible for these words to become words themselves, and you forget after a while that scuba is that the letters of scuba stand for
actually
something.
Stand for something. Yeah. We have an email here, and this and I want to raise this because it was something that I want to ask you about as well. And I think a lot of people I've noodled around on the web and seen other people have asked this question. People have been going to see the new version of True Grit.
I haven't seen that.
And one of the things that they're struck by is the unusual use of language by the characters, which apparently comes out fairly directly out of the novel by Charles Portis.
Okay.
The thing that people notice is...
the Coen brothers I read were very enamored of.
They were very enamored of, and I think that actually a lot of the dialogue in the film, they said...
Taken right
from the book. Right. And one of the things that people notice is that it seems that the characters are not using any contractions. Now, apparently, if you actually look at not only at the script, but you look at the book, in fact, they do use some,
mm-hmm.
maybe not as many as we do, but they do use some. And this led to a lot of people asking this question, well, did not people use contractions in the 19th? Did not people use contractions in the 19th century?
Didn't. Yeah, I don't know. The thing is, well, you see the words, well, we don't have tape recordings of what people said in the 19th century. We have simply written out versions of what they said, and the performance and the script are not necessarily the same thing. So it's a little hard to tell, but certainly commentary suggests that people were contracting. For example, I've looked at comments around the word ain't
mm-hmm.
in the 19th century when they start to appear. And the controversy was really what was the appropriate contraction for the first person singular. Everybody was against amn't. See, we have isn't, aren't, wasn't, weren't. Those are fine. But the first person singular was the flashpoint for some reason. And amn't was variously condemned as belonging to Irish slang and therefore not good English or just ignorant use of the language. And so they didn't like amn't for am not. And so the actually approved form for first person singular was ain't. Where ain't was condemned was when it was used for second or third person. You ain't, he ain't, she ain't. They ain't. But it was for a while in the 19th century, the usage commentator said ain't only for first person singular.
Hmm.
And it seems to come from this sort of R-less British pronunciation that it's a reduction of aren't, aunt, ain't.
Huh. Okay.
But I don't know if that is actually the case, but that was one of the things that was suggested. If you read old Dorothy Sayers' mysteries from the early 1900s, you see Lord Peter Wimsey says, I ain't, a lot. It was acceptable upper-class slang for conversation, not for writing, but for conversation. And the other thing is that the contractions were often frowned on in written language. So I don't know. I haven't seen True Grit, either of the versions.
Yeah, not even the famous one with John Wayne.
I was not a John Wayne fan for some reason. I liked Stagecoach, but I will guess, and you can tell me if this is plausible or wrong, that in period pieces. Evocative of things like the Old West, or even, you know, earlier other aspects of American history. Using uncontracted speech is a way of sounding older, putting it in giving it historical authenticity. That is probably just an illusion.
Mm.
I think people did contract their spoken speech as much as they do today.
All right. Very well. We have about 7-8 minutes left here, and some of the callers.
To make a short story long.
Try to accommodate all of them. I know people are just waiting. They're counting down the minutes until we're done. Matt Toon is next, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Last night while I was watching Channel 12-3 Create, there was a travelogue. And at the bottom of one picture, it showed the word restaurateur.
Mm.
That word is so misused so often instead of restaurateur, which is proper. And I wondered if in time it will be accepted.
I don't know. If it's used often enough with the N in it, it will. Because there's just no way around it. That's how, you know, that's how things change. A lot of change comes from what some people perceive to be a mistake.
I don't remember that word being quite so well used years ago. Is it because people are traveling more?
Either in the correct or incorrect form, you mean?
In the, either way.
Yeah, it means the proprietor of a restaurant.
Yes, yes.
And because we say restaurant, that sort of conditions us to put the N in rest, what originally was restaurateur.
Is restaurateur a French word?
Oh, yes. Yes, a lot of our restaurant terms, even restaurant itself, are French derived.
Well, are we anglicizing it then?
Sure. And yes, and we, you know, we give in England and America, we give a lot of status to French cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one reason why we, you know, we put a lot of French terms on our menus. And in our restaurant talk, the word entree in American restaurant menus is a term we, and so when we do that, we sometimes change the meaning. So entree in an American menu is the main course, but entree in a French menu is the appetizer.
Yes.
It's the entree. It's the entrance.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So really that can be
the starter.
Acceptable then.
It could be eventually, yeah.
But I was really surprised to see it misspelled on a travel log.
Right, yeah.
Well, yeah. I thank you, sir.
Thank you. You're welcome. Let us go to Indiana. Someone here on the cell phone, line two. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Thank you for taking my call. My wife would be impressed that I've listened to your show for this long.
I'm impressed anybody listens to it for this long.
I like the old man in Robinson. I'm an old man, and over the years, I've had to deal with a lot of life situations with people and give advice. And I have found that the word problem, if it comes from me, I am very judgmental, and they receive it as though it's coming with a judgmental attitude, whether I have one or not.
Mm-hmm.
If I discuss issues, it's not a negative thing.
It's less confrontational.
It's not confrontational, mm-hmm. and I get a chance to hear them.
Okay.
But I find that people choosing to use these words, if I want to prove my rightness, I'm going to say you got a problem.
Mm-hmm.
If I want them to learn from the situation, I talk to them about dealing with issues.
Okay.
And so I think there's a place for each word. And I don't think one supersedes the other. I think there's a different place to use them,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
depending on the effect that you want. If I want you to know I'm right, I'll let you know.
Okay.
Otherwise, I will give you words that will help you try to work something out on your own. So
okay.
I just wanted to share that with you, and I thank you very much for that opportunity.
No problem.
I appreciate it. I like that. See, someone
should
is
say
actually
no issue.
No issue. With it. You don't have any issues. Here's it. Reflect some degree of thought about the shades of meaning
that's
in the two words
we,
and why you would want
need.
To use them.
Yeah, that's what we need.
All right. Let's see. Let's next.
Think before you speak, something I would do well to
that's,
practice
it's
myself.
It's very difficult. It
very
is very difficult,
difficult. Especially when that red light on the air is on. Mm-hmm. Boy,
you have to fill the time with something.
Got to fill the time. Dead air is just, it's worse on the radio than it is in the classroom, believe me.
Do you have a lot of dead air in the classroom?
We have a lot of dead air in the classroom.
All right. Let's go
and
to.
And I do my best to fill it.
That's what they pay you for. Line three, champagne. Hello.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I love these conversations, and I'm not an old man or anything.
there you go.
My question is, I've heard a lot of people use the word historical, and is that taking the place now of historic? Because I think
that's been the case for some time. There have been questions about this for 30, 40 years, I think, at least.
Okay, maybe I am old. Is there a differentiation between the two things? Same as symmetric. I hear people say, oh, it's symmetric. No, it's symmetrical.
Oh, that's interesting. I haven't really noticed that one, but I will look for it.
Because I'm curious if it's just being interchanged or if there really is a difference.
They're starting to become interchanged.
That's my sense.
Yeah.
Historical, they think it sounds better. It's longer of a word. I'm like,
yeah, I think it gives it more gravitas.
Well, I don't
know. This is what people maybe
It
think.
Makes me look down on
There you go. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
It actually gives the word levitas.
There you go.
Thank you
Thank
for the call.
You.
One more here. We'll try to do this. Urbana Line 1. Hello.
Hello. I just have a suggestion for determining the prevalence of contractions in the 1800s. I would turn to Mark Twain, who did his very best to reproduce
the spoken.
The spoken language,
mm-hmm. and you know there are he was one of many, and there in fact there
say.
Was it was a journalistic tradition that he comes out of that kind of written recording of spoken dialogue. So, yeah, that certainly is a place.
My recollection from reading that genre is there was a good deal of contraction.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I would suggest one reason for there perhaps being a perception there wasn't was the emphasis schoolma'ams made on enunciation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the sense, too, that in formal writing you shouldn't contract. And, of course, Twain was using this in dialogue. And
The Queen's English, of course, always contained the word ain't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Always?
Always.
Well, always is a long time.
Ah.
But in recent history, I think since probably the 1600s or so, when English really began to take its modern form, that was often commented upon, that the aristocracy used that form while the middle class seemed to frown upon it.
Well, that was certainly the case in the early 1900s,
yes.
Apparently. And I don't know about going back to the 17th century, but certainly you start seeing discussions of ain't in the last quarter of the 19th century.
There were, of course, a number of purists who tried to introduce Latinizations into English and various other things to reform the language in their view. So you have to be rather careful with their criticisms, as you know, of course. Well, I'm enjoying your program, so thanks.
Well, thank you for the call. We're going to have to finish. Last word of wisdom? Dead air.
Dead air.
Very
dead
good.
Air. Last word of wisdom, WTF.
All right. With that, we say thanks to Dennis Barron. He's professor of English at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign.
You are more welcome than you will know.
Thank you very much. And The Web of Language is his blog, if you'd like to read some of his writings, his musings on language. Also, his most recent book, you might like to look at that. It's about how the digital revolution has influenced the way that we read and write, and the title is A Better Pencil, Readers, Writers, and the Digital Revolution.
There is a Kindle version of that.
Indeed.
Indeed.
All right, then. Hey, thank you very much for being here.
Great to be here.